I'm now going to continue dubbing in from the tape, What Is It All About? Hopefully you can hear what is being said. I realize there's much background noise, but the best I can do for just now until I can redo this whole thing, if time ever permits and God's holy will be done.
I have a quote, but now I'll be reading from the section of the letter of August 7th, 1984, quote, viewed broadly, the natural law constitutes a source for the canon law for the reason that certain precepts of the natural law are common to all mankind and are found in every legal system. E.g., for example, quote, the accused must be given a fair opportunity to defend himself, end quote. Accordingly, a sentence passed without hearing the other party would be contrary to the natural law and legally null. For among all nations, this maxim is held to be sacred. The other party must be heard. And now I will read from the letter of Father Dennis Minimary, written on the Feast of Lay. I have not forbidden the laity to listen to both sides of the question and then make an informed decision. What is it that you are afraid of? I have many times made the offer, and it still stands, to meet you publicly and discuss these problems in an open forum in the presence of the laity. You know that I am not motivated by an ambition for power. You know that I am not a liar. You know that my whole priesthood has been totally dedicated to the service of the church and souls. You know, too, that I will not sit idly by while souls are destroyed and the community is ruined. I am sure that Bishop Shelcart does not realize how painful this action has been, and it has been very painful to me, but it was truly necessary. Necessary for the good of souls, necessary for the church, and necessary for Bishop Shelcart. In summary, I believe that my previous statement clearly and accurately explains my position. I stand behind it, and I reiterate each and all the accusations made in it. If one of us is a liar, it is certainly not I. So if he stands behind all that he said, and if he's not a liar, then I certainly cannot understand why everyone cannot hear these tapes and listen to anything that we might wish to discuss in public. And I only guess time will wait and see if Father is a liar, and if he tries to stop people from coming and turning out to a public meeting and listening to what we might have to discuss at some future date with the help of Jesus, Mary, and St. Joseph and all the heavenly court.
Well, as Father said, I think you have all the facts. Well, I personally think that maybe everyone does not have all of the facts. Therefore, I would like you to now listen to this phone conversation I had with a Mr. Paul Stremmer. His address is Post Office Box 116, Eureka, Montana, zip code 59917, phone number 406-889-3583. And this phone conversation took place on October 30th, 1984.
I've been down the same road. I don't know if Father Lucian, how much of my background he gave you.
Well, just hardly any. He just said that you were a layman who did some research on a bishop up in your country, and that's why you had this information.
Okay. The research wasn't done accidentally. I'll give you a little background. I'm 36 years old. I'm the father of six. Been married for 14 years. I met a Joseph Maria Robert, who claims to be a priest and bishop, and he goes into those Catholic lines, some of them through Arm Parish Matthew, and he was ordained and consecrated by John of Trinity in Jesuit in Canada. John of Trinity was a religious entrepreneur, had been originally a Catholic priest, validly and licitly ordained, but then obtained orders outside the church from a man that claimed to be a Pope, Clement XV.
Right, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I meant to tell you when I first started my conversation,
yeah,
I'm trying to tape this conversation because I want to get this information down. I won't keep it all in my head, if that's all right with you.
Well, that's fine with me.
All right, thank you.
I have nothing to hide, and everything that I tell you is from memory. Now, my memory may not be perfect, but I should be able to back up everything that I tell you from these people's own records and so forth. And if I say something that's opinion, I'll try and say that that's opinion, so that you won't be confused.
I just didn't want to try and pony faster than you, because I do want this down on tape if it'll work, you know?
Well, that's fine. I'll give you a chance to check your tape and see that it's recording if you'd like.
Well, that's all right.
All right. Anyway, I became, in 7 years of defending this Joseph Ria's orders, I would take my family to his masses every day, and I gradually became more and more involved with him until he finally had the idea, since I had a chapel in Big Fork, Montana. He had the idea one time that he figured I should be a deacon. So I imagine that appealed to my pride fairly well, and he wasn't there to, no one was there to tell me not to. And I wasn't studying canon law and dogmatic and moral theology and any of the church teachings like I should have. Anyway, I got conned into it. And because I was so involved with him, I began to defend his orders, because naturally, like a man in your situation, you'd either want those orders to be valid or not, you know. You have to have your feet on the ground. Well, in 6 or 7 years of trying to defend his orders, I ran up against a solid brick wall. Everywhere I turned, when they finally got to the questioning of how was it done and what lines did he go into and so on, it always came up doubtful. And finally, another priest came and stayed with us for 6 months and 3 days.
And lived at your place, you mean? I'm interrupting this phone conversation to just remind us that it is the same Bishop Arnold Harris Matthew who is the key man tracing back the lineage of the bishops for Bishop Francis Schuckardt. And most of you probably have already certainly aware of this. I only remind us this because of the things you're going to hear later in this conversation to show you what these old Catholics have been doing. Francis Schuckardt says he comes from,
yes.
Eventually goes back to Matthew.
Right, it does. Now, there have been debates on that question since all of this stuff has taken place, you see, since Matthew lived. But it's never been decided by the church. That's the whole point. The whole crux of the situation is that who are we to decide a matter for ourselves that the church refused to decide? You see?
Right.
My idea was, if I can't prove that they're valid, then what business have I got going to this man's mass? Now, from what I understand of the teachings of the church, we're not allowed to go to sacraments that are doubtful as to their validity, and in normal times, even their licentiousness. They have to be valid and licit, and we have to be able to be morally certain that they're valid and licit. Now, it is licit according to the law, Canon 2261, that in abnormal times and emergencies, at the point of death and so on and so forth, you can approach heretics. But the 2261 even states that you have to be certain that the orders are valid. So we quit going to Joseph Maria Robert. And
right.
I backed up just like you're doing, and I admire you for that, because I know it takes some courage and it takes a lot of humility and a lot of patience with yourself and real dedication to the truth to stop acting, you know, like you've been used to for all those years, and change your life and take it all back and be willing. That shows a tremendous sincerity as far as I'm concerned, and I think the good Lord loves you for it. I don't know who it was that ordained or consecrated Daniel Q. Brown. Do you?
Rogers.
Rogers.
As far as I know, there's two opinions, but it seems that Rogers was the one. I have a little bit of information from people, but that's what I have down anyway. See, I don't know too much about it. I haven't really checked up until recently, unfortunately, but...
I have seen that line of succession from Dan Q. Brown on back, but darn if I can find it. I was looking for it when Father Lucian was here and didn't have any luck, and I still haven't found it. I know it's around here somewhere, because it's one of the lines that Joseph Maria Robert used to try and defend his own orders. And when he was so heavily spoken against by the people in the Society of Pius X in Montana, then he dropped that line and went to a line that goes back to the Eastern Orthodox. And of course, it didn't have much of an effect, because the way his was done by the man in England that conditionally reconsecrated him still leaves it doubtful, even if that particular individual's orders were valid. There was no way to prove any of it. So, I don't know how much training you guys got as far as moral and dogmatic theology or canon law or any of it, but just from my own study, and this is completely unguided with the exception of a few priests that I'd ask questions of every now and again, I came to the conclusion that we had to have at least the least of the three certainties, moral certitude, on the sacraments. Otherwise, go someplace else or don't go at all. Now, does that make any sense to you?
That's why I'm here, not up there.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that that's the only route we've got.
Well, one thing that, do you have enough research to know that, from what I understand, it would seem that Bishop Matthews was valid, but, you know, then the only thing that seems wrong now is that St. Pius X not only excommunicated him, but he also questioned his validity. Is that right?
Well, Matthew himself could have been valid. We don't know. He was in and out of the church so many times that it's hard to, you know. I've got a history of him, too, written by the Society of Pius X. In fact, when you write to those guys, you should ask them for everything they've got on the old Catholics, particularly the Matthew line, because they have researched all of that thoroughly, and they have the succession and the whole smear all in print. It's appeared as a series of articles in their publications, the Roman Catholic and the Angelus. That'd be very valuable to you. Even if Matthew was valid, all the shenanigans and the simony and so forth that went on when he started consecrating in
In other words, he might have been all right, but he didn't do what was right to pass it to his next successors.
Or one of those guys didn't do it.
Right.
Correctly. I know there were some of those guys that they'd ordain anybody just at the drop of a hat. Well, I'll tell you a little story. Just to give you an example of how those guys get after a while. This local guy here, he had ordained another guy as a deacon before I came into the picture. And then the guy wasn't satisfied. He prevailed upon this Joseph Maria to make him a priest. And Joseph Maria wouldn't do that because he's gotten so much heat before because he'd ordained many, many married men before. So he shied away. He was gun shy. But he said, I know a guy that'll ordain for near anybody. A guy by the name of, I've forgotten his name. Anyway, he lives in Montreal, Canada. Oh, he wrote a letter up there and introduced him. Oh, it was Andre Barbeau was the guy's name. My wife reminded me. And he introduced him by letter. And then a few weeks later, the other local guy went up there, the guy that was a deacon, he went up there, and Andre Barbeau made him a priest and offered to make him a bishop right there on the spot.
That quick with no...
Pardon me?
That quick with no more knowledge of him than that?
Right there on the spot. In any case, later on, I couldn't get any verification out of any of them. You know, I found out later on when this Father Watson from the Knights of Malta was up here that the original orders that the man had up in San Jovite were... this Clement XV had claimed that an angel had made him a bishop. Now, he was also a Roman Catholic priest, and so was this John of Trinity. They were both validly and licitly ordained in the church, and then they left the church and obtained their consecrations as bishops outside. This Clement XV claimed that an angel had come and made him a bishop, and then he proceeded to consecrate John of Trinity. Well, then this John of Trinity made Joseph Maria down here in Kalispell a priest and a bishop, supposedly. And he knew no more about the validity of orders. He actually believed that he was a priest and a bishop by an angel. Third time removed. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So they were traveling in England, this John of Trinity and Joseph Maria Roberry. And they came on to this old Catholic by the name of Brerley. He had a little church in London. And he heard their story and heard what they were trying to do, and they were supposed to be sticking to tradition. This was when Paul VI was supposedly a pope.
I'm interrupting the phone conversation here to call our attention again to the fact that this Burley in England goes to the old Catholic line, that same line that Francis Schuckardt came from. I wanted to bring this out because of what you're going to hear now, and there is documented proof which he sent me of this fact.
All this out, and of course they refused to do it conditionally. technology and so forth. And so we had no choice, Pat, but just to pull the plug, like you're doing, and then try and get our information as straight as possible and present it as straight as we know how, as truthfully as we know how, to those of our relatives that are still going to him, just like you're trying to do with your brother. And I'll give you just by way of a little bit of, so you know what to expect. It's very difficult. You've already been through this probably to some extent. It's very difficult to get anybody to see it, mostly because, you know, people, they want to be Catholics, and that's admirable. And they see something dreadfully wrong with the Novus Ordo Church. So anybody, almost anybody that comes down the pike that says the true mass, boy, they're ready to jump on the bandwagon and stay there. And they're willing to overlook all kinds of errors and garbage, scandal, and what have you, to grasp that and hang on to it. Of course, there's a lot of psychology that goes in on that, a lot of spiritual things, a lot of temptations and so forth. That's why they don't see the light. But I guess all we can do is just keep trying, try and get our information straight.
We have just heard some of what Mr. Paul Stemmer had to tell us with regards to the whole Catholic line tracing back through Arnold Harris Matthews, plus many other things that I did not put onto this tape. And again, he does not make simply just flat statements. He bases his conversation on documented articles and personal contact with those whom he was involved with. And now, because Father Dennis Flamery, as we've already heard at the beginning of this tape, says we should get clearly both sides of the picture or hear all the facts, I will now dub on to hear from the San Diego Seminar 1983, the question-answer period by Bishop Francis Conrad Maria Schuckard. This tape was played for the entire community in the gymnasium a few months after the seminar in San Diego. I'm only going to play the part where the bishop explains about the ordinations from the whole schismatic line.
Which exact canon law states that a schismatic need only confess his error in front of witnesses in order to re-enter the Catholic Church versus being reordained or reconsecrated by a bishop? There is no such thing as being reordained or reconsecrated. Once you're ordained, you're ordained. And once you are consecrated, you are consecrated. It is common knowledge that the priests and bishops of the schismatic churches are validly ordained and consecrated.
I will interrupt this tape at certain times rather than to come back to these points later. Schismatics may validly ordain and consecrate, but they never do so licitly, lawfully, and they never have any Catholic jurisdiction.
There are, of course, a few exceptions. I would suppose this might refer to Bishop Brown, the bishop who consecrated myself. And we must remember that Bishop Brown was born a Catholic, raised a Catholic. And it was only when Vatican II began to make such drastic changes in the faith that he in conscience could not go along with those changes. And renouncing Vatican II was then consecrated in the old Roman Catholic Church, because he knew for certain that that church had valid orders, while the Church of Vatican II does not. Before we would accept ordination and consecration from the hands of the bishop, we insisted that he follow that particular custom established by Holy Mother Church of a renunciation in public of his error. Now, in past centuries, as we read the history of the Church, we realize that on more than one occasion, large numbers of schismatics were allowed to return to the faith. For instance, we can go back to the time of the Arian heresy, and we find that 80-90% of the clergy and the hierarchy were in heresy. Now, when there were such very large numbers, and they had no access to a bishop or priest for absolution, Holy Mother Church, in those decrees issued by the Holy Office, stated simply that a schismatic priest or bishop who has not access to a validly consecrated and a bishop of lawful authority should then abjure his errors in the presence of two witnesses publicly.
What Bishop Chuckard just stated may be true, but also may not be true. If anyone knows what decree or documentation he is referring to, I would like to see it myself. But one thing we do know, that even if they abjured their error before two witnesses publicly, that was basically only an acknowledgement that they had made a mistake. At least it is certain that such an act of abjuration could not in any way give them back Catholic jurisdiction. And this point about receiving Catholic jurisdiction, I will try to explain later on in this tape, because it always, lawful jurisdiction must always be given by someone who already has it.
And it's very obvious, or it should be to those who are here, that after the Second Vatican Council, all of the bishops who participated in that heretical council, by virtue of having gone back to their own areas and having promulgated the heretical decrees of that heretical council, according to church teaching, were ipso facto excommunicated as soon as they implemented the teaching of Vatican II in their dioceses. They were automatically excommunicated for publicly promulgating heresy.
But Bishop Chuckart neglected to tell us was that schismatics also incur ipso facto excommunication. And we know that Bishop Daniel Q. Brown, all the way back to the old Catholic line, were schismatics. Let us then turn to a practical commentary of the Court of Canon Law by Woolward, Volume 2, page 465. All apostates from the Christian faith and each and every heretic or schismatic incur the following penalties. 1. Ipso facto excommunication, automatic excommunication, that means. 2. If they have been admonished and do not repent, they shall be deprived of any benefice, dignity, pension, office, or any possessions which they may hold in the church. They shall be declared infamous, and if they are clerics, they shall, after renowned admonition, be deposed. 3. If they have joined a non-Catholic sect or have publicly adhered to it, they incur infamy ipso facto, and if they are clerics and the admonition to repent has been fruitless, they shall be degraded. Canon 188, number 4, provides, moreover, that the cleric who publicly abandons the Catholic faith loses every ecclesiastical office ipso facto without any declaration. That is Canon 2314, number 1. Absolution in the internal forum from the excommunication mentioned in the preceding paragraph is reserved in a special manner to the Apostolic See. If, however, the offense of apostasy, heresy, or schism has in any way been brought to the external forum of the local ordinary, even by voluntary confession, the ordinary, but not the vicar general, unless he has a special mandate, can absolve the repentant sinner in the external forum by his ordinary authority. After the jurisdictional abjuration has been made and the other conditions demanded in law have been fulfilled, when he has been thus absolved from the censure
The offender may then be absolved from the sin of the internal form by any confessor. The abjuration is made in jurisdictional forum when it takes place in the presence of the local ordinary or his delegate and at least two witnesses. And that's Canon 2314, number 2. And that's all I'm going to read for now from the Canon Law book, but some comments to bring out in a special way is the fact that those who joined the old Roman Catholic rite went into schism, thereby incurred automatic excommunication. And this particular excommunication is also then reserved in a special manner to the Apostolic See. And we also, from what history we know, the case of Daniel Q. Brown and Bishop Shuckart, this offense of schism had never in any way even been brought to the external forum of the local ordinary. And this abjuration in the external forum before the local ordinary, who has the jurisdiction himself to absolve, is absolutely necessary. For remember that last sentence we'd read from the book. The abjuration is made in jurisdictional form when it takes place in the presence of the local ordinary or his delegate and at least two witnesses. It does not read or at least two witnesses, but and at least two witnesses. And furthermore, let us note that all apostates, heretics, and schismatics under this Canon 188, number 4, who abandon the Catholic faith, lose every ecclesiastical office ipso facto without any declaration. And that office absolutely has to be given back. It cannot just be assumed. You cannot invoke Epikaya. You cannot invoke Canon 209. It has to be given by someone who still has an office. And maybe we will try to explain this later on in these tapes. But for now, we will just go on with what Bishop Francis Shuckart said at the San Diego Seminar in 1983.
We know that it was because of this that almost every bishop throughout the world had excommunicated himself by promulgating the heresies of Vatican II and the later destruction of the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass by Bernini and Paul VI. It was impossible for the Vatican II Church to have licit orders or licit bishops. They were heretical and worse than schismatic.
I interrupt the tape here of the talk of Bishop Shuckart to draw special attention to the fact that at this point he is making a good distinction that those bishops, although at least the older ones, we still presume are validly consecrated, they are no longer licit. And now I would like to dive into here part of the tape of Bishop George Musey when he's talked to the community on April 22nd, 1985.
Of Bishop Francis as to whether or not he was schismatic. Well, Bishop Francis was consecrated, ordained and consecrated by a bishop who was a schismatic. He was an old Catholic bishop. The fact of the abjuration really does not necessarily restore the man to the Catholic Church. The simple fact of making an abjuration is simply a declaration that we've made a mistake. Now, who then in authority in the Catholic Church accepted that abjuration and relieved the man of his censures and restored him? It's kind of like going to confession. You might go to confession and you might make your confession, but who is going to give you absolution unless you go to a qualified priest who can actually absolve you from your sins? Confession's only part of it. The priest has to be one who has the power and the faculties, of course, to absolve from the sin, and in case of a censure, also from the censure. The same with the abjuration of heresy, that the person would have to be one, if he made his abjuration of heresy, it would have had to have been made to one in that had the authority in and from the Catholic Church to receive that abjuration and to absolve the man from his censure and receive him into the Catholic Church.
And this point expressed by Bishop George Musty is a very, very, very important point, which I try to stress that every one of us will remember in the things that must necessarily be explained hereafter. There must be, and just before Bishop Musty spoke, we heard Bishop Shuckart tell us that those bishops who implemented in their diocese the documents of Vatican II were no longer licit, and they were worse than schismatics. So now let us turn to the Summa of St. Thomas Aquinas. Under question 39, article 3 of part 2 of part 2, third article, whether schismatics have any power. Objection 1. It would seem that schismatics have some power, for Augustine says, just as those who come back to the church after being baptized are not baptized again, so those who return after being ordained are not ordained again. Now, order is a kind of power. Therefore, schismatics have some power since they retain their orders. Remember, this is the objection that is pointed out. And now we turn to what St. Thomas Aquinas, the Prince of Theologians, writes on the contrary. Cyprian says in a letter, he who observes neither unity of spirit nor the concord of peace and severs himself from the bonds of the church and from the fellowship of her priests cannot have episcopal power or honor. St. Thomas goes on to write, I answer that spiritual power is twofold, the one sacramental and the other the power of jurisdiction. The sacramental power is one that is conferred by some kind of consecration. Now all the consecrations of the church are immovable so long as the consecrated thing remains, as appears even in inanimate things, since an altar once consecrated is not consecrated again unless it has been broken up. Consequently, such a power as this remains as to its essence in the man who has received it by consecration as long as he lives, even if he fall into schism or heresy. And this is proved from the fact that if he come back to the church, he is not consecrated anew. Since, however, the lower power ought not to exercise its act except in so far as it is moved by the higher power, as may be seen also in the physical order, it follows that such persons lose the use of their power, so that it is not lawful for them to use it. Yet if they use it, this power has its effect in sacramental acts, because therein man acts only as God's instrument, so that sacramental effects are not precluded on account of any fault whatever in the person who confers the sacrament. On the other hand, the power of jurisdiction is that which is conferred by a mere human appointment. Such a power as this does not adhere to the recipient immovably, so that it does not remain in heretics and schismatics. And consequently, they neither absolve, nor excommunicate, nor grant indulgences, nor do anything of the kind. And if they do, it is invalid. Accordingly, when it is said that such like persons have no spiritual power, it is to be understood as referring either to the second power, or if it be referred to the first power, not as referring to the essence of the power, but to its lawful use. And from this teaching of St. Thomas Aquinas, the Prince of Theologians, it is made very clear that schismatics and heretics always lose the use of their power, so that it is not lawful, in other words, it's not licit, it is sinful for them to use it. Although they do use the power of orders, they can still consecrate
validly consecrate or validly ordain another bishop or priest. However, the power of jurisdiction is always conferred by a mere appointment of a human being. And all schismatics and heretics automatically lose this power of jurisdiction when they go into schism or heresy. And they never get it back from another schismatic or heretic. It has to come from someone who is still in and of the Catholic Church, who still himself retains this power of jurisdiction. And consequently, they neither absolve, nor excommunicate, nor grant indulgences, nor do anything of the kind. Of the kind he means there anything that requires jurisdiction in and of the Catholic Church. And if they do, it is invalid. And this, again, is such a very, very, very important point that anyone who goes into heresy or schism automatically is excommunicated, and they lose automatically any Catholic jurisdiction they may have had. And as Bishop Musick correctly pointed out, Bishop Daniel Q. Brown was in schism, receiving his orders in a schismatical church, and therefore he automatically lost his power of jurisdiction, which means very plainly that he must get it back from someone who is still in and of the Catholic Church. And until such time as that can happen, whatever they do as far as supposedly using their power of jurisdiction, it is invalid. And whatever they do using their power of orders is always illicit, sinful. The only possible exceptions to what I just stated might be under certain circumstances and cases of danger of death. And again, this is such a very important point. I wish to stress to remember it, because I will need to recall these things to mind again when we speak about religious orders, religious congregations, and religious vows. And because of the importance of these matters, I'm going to give you more reference sources besides just the Summa of St. Thomas Aquinas. Now I'm going to refer to a manual of pastoral theology by the Reverend Frederick, spells his last name S-C-H-U-L-C-E-D-D. This book was published by the Herder Book Company in 1923. That's when the copyright is. It has a nickel upstate on the 20th of July, 1927 by Johannes Rothsteiner, and an imprimatur by Johannes J. Glennon. And now I turn to page 295 of this book, under the chapter of Holy Orders.